Section number 11448, Rule 3.
Rule 3?
Pardon?
Rule 3, if you could continue.
Oh, yes. Now, as I say, we were expecting the chats to come within 24 hours, but it went into 2 days, then to 3 days, then to 4 days. And when they finally turned up, I asked this one of the lads there, where the heck have they been? And it turned out, as they were getting ready to come away, the Americans are moving in to take our positions over. But apparently they made so much noise, so much racket. Jerry just lamb-blasted the place. Shelled it, malted it, and everything else.
What was this place?
Just outside Venlo. They'd done everything, so because our chaps was kept back because it was believed at the time that he might be putting a push through, you see. Then when the boys came, within about a couple of days, 3 days, we got brought back to Blighty again in preparation for the Rhine crossing. And then again, as I say, more training, more parachute exercises. And then eventually came the day, which was the 23rd of March on a Friday. We got taken down to, well, I now know the name of the place is Boreham in Chelmsford. We got taken down there to a camp, got ourselves settled in. When that was done, we was then taken down to the airfield at Boreham. There we was issued with our parachute. There to be fitted, names attached, and then they were stacked away in readiness. So it was just the question the next morning, take your chute, put it on, and that was it. Well then, we met the air crews. Our particular aircraft had 4 parachutes painted under the pilot's window. So he'd done a couple of drops D-Day at Arnhem, you know, with the Americans. And we then come back to camp. We had a church service. It's hard to believe this. Anybody was invited. I mean, when it was a church service, whether he was Jewish, Roman Catholic, Protestant or whatever, everybody went to that. He never kept that. That one, everybody seemed to go for one reason. Prayer, faith, wasn't it? We even had an atheist turned up, a man who reckoned he was an outright atheist, but he turned up at this church service. So, and then it was a question of, you know, checking your weapons, getting everything you wanted, sewing extra pockets on the trousers, attaching you to your helmet. Everybody used to attach extra field dressings, large field dressings. In your pockets went whatever you wanted. Mainly, most of the blokes used to put the 808 explosive for the old gamma bombs. Now, that was quite safe, that stuff. We used to light fires with it, actually. You just got a little piece, put a match, it just fizzed, and that was it, simple. But it was a terrific explosive. It was done properly with a detonator, packed properly and everything. It was one of the most devastating hand bombs that I know of, you see. So you done that, any extra pieces that you wanted, more, you know, extra fags, extra sweets, whatever you can get in those pockets you took, even ammunition, grenades, phosphorus grenades, although that was he was advised not to do. One lad did, and he was hit. Though with the phosphorus bomb was hit, he got badly burned. But, and then that was it, back to bed. You know, we went in the naffy, but then to bed, and you went to bed with your own thoughts of what was going to happen the following day, you see. And then 3 o'clock the next morning was reveille, wash, shave, food, grub sort of style. So you know what a condemned man feels like. And then another talk by the commanding officer. I was supposed to try and relieve our fears and thoughts, and at the same time trying to put over to us, you know, the job that we had to do. And then there was another small church service was held by our padre, and then another chat by our own company commander, Tiger Reed. Don't ask me how he was named Tiger, he doesn't know himself. But he wasn't a ferocious man in that respect, he was a disciplinarian. You couldn't muck about with the man. But, and in the trucks, Down we went to the airfield. It was the most beautiful, even better days than what we've had this last couple of weeks. Beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. And then it was just a question again of your chutes, fitting them over. You used to have a coverall that you put over your own equipment, and then the chute went over that. I had a kit bag that I had to take. Now, in that kit bag, you could take anything, pieces of the 2-inch mortar, or extra ammunition, medical supplies, whatever they wanted. And it was just a question of once you got down, you just left it. Yeah, that was collected later. Well, then we went over, we met our air crew, we met our aircraft again, and then he asked Lofty Hinman, you know what, how long did he expect us, you know, expect the red, etc. and so forth, how long it would take to get out the aircraft. And I shall always remember Lofty's words, because if there was a pun, this was it. He said, we don't want to hang around. And I've never forgotten those words. He said, we'll get out as quick as we can, we don't want to hang around, see. Well, again, we got in the aircraft, mixed feelings, you know. And when you looked around, you thought, Christ, you know, how's this all going to come together? Because it looked such a jumble, it looked such a mess, it really did. But then once you got settled in, everybody sorted their places out, that was it. You went in reverse order, 20 went in first, then 19 and so forth, so that they came out in their right order, you see. And then...
This was another Starling, was it?
Pardon?
This was another Starling.
No, Dakota. It was the finest aircraft, make no mistake about it. You couldn't better another aircraft for it. And then the engine started up, the orders come, we're moving. But again, it seemed a hell of a long time before that aircraft took off. And when it did, bearing in mind now it's daylight. Now, from where we could see through the door, because we didn't have the door on it, that was taken off, and through the windows, you never see a sight like it once they formed up. One of the most magnificent sights. What it was like to people on the ground, I shall never know. They reckon there was 1,700 aircraft, 1,300 gliders, and that wasn't counting the fighters that were zooming around us. We were well protected, make no mistake about it. It must have been the most magnificent sight going, but every town, every village, every city that we passed, how many mothers, how many wives looking up thought, well, is my husband there? Will they get that telegram the War Office regrets? That's the only thought, you know. But and then, as I say, we went over, the sight was magnificent, but again, all I thought of was, like my wife, then we'd been married 4 months and 2 days. My mum and dad, her mother and dad, I even went back, you know, school days, leaving school, air pageant days, my first job, paper rounds, all that sort of thing. My job in the ARP, as it was then, and became the civil defence later, where I was promoted from messenger to warden, the bombs that had dropped, the sights I'd seen. And then we came over the Dutch coast. That was a beautiful sight to see. And then we came up to the Rhine and we looked down, and it's hard to start to describe it. It looked like as though it was like a milk white haze all over the ground. What we didn't know, they put in a heavy barrage. Of course, this was the result. The wind had come up a bit and had blown that smoke over the D's head, you see. Well, then, as we crossed the Rhine, then you could hear the old crump, crump, crump of the airbursts. Well, unbeknown to us, you see, that those airbursts, they burst upwards. Whether the Yanks knew it or not, we don't know, because they went up. Now, the recorded height for that jump, instead of being 400 feet, which is our normal maximum jump for jumping into action, in some cases it was between 900 to 1,400 feet. So you can just imagine you're taking twice as long to get down, you see. And our aircraft was hit in the wing, near the port aileron, on the port side. But from where I sat, we could see it, but it looked about the size of a dinner plate, really. But he was still flying, so give the bloke his due, or the pilot, as I should say. He carried on. Red came on, green came on, and out we went. I was number 7. But the small arms fire, I couldn't believe it. We was told the area would be cleared. But the amount of small arms fire was terrific. Unbelievable. But again, you see, you've got so much on your mind. It shoots open, oscillation, drop the kit bag, get that down, look around, make sure everything. put your hands up to dampen the swing, and as I can, I thought I could feel this warmth down my arm when I looked up, and there you can see it there, there's the result.
On your thumb?
On the thumb. And I looked up, two of the rigging lines had been snapped. So I thought, well, it can only be two things. It's got to be a bullet or it's got to be shrapnel. It can't be anything else. But I don't mind admitting, I thought, Christ, they've got me. Out of all this crowd here, they spotted me. You see, anyway, nothing I could do about it. And I came down. My chute landed across some telephone wires. It was on the Autobahn, or unfinished Autobahn, as it was. And I released the kit bag, left that, jumped over the fencing, the bit of wire fencing there, and I teamed up with my platoon officer and the other lads. Major Reed came on the scene, and we made our way to the woods. That was our objective anyway. When we got in there, you never see a sight like it. It turned out there was 32 altogether, but these chaps were just hanging in the trees, dead. Where they'd been shot by the Germans. It was just their bad luck, really. Helpless, couldn't do a thing about it. But we didn't realise that at the time. One of the chaps, when he spotted it, hang on, lads, we'll get you down. And Katina got no money, went, oh, Jesus Christ, they're dead. Because, again, you've got to say it, and I'm going to be honest about it, panic sets in, the backside starts going like that, this thing goes like that, I think, Christ, where's Jerry?
Your heart starts thumping.
Oh, you do. I mean, straight away when you see somebody dead in the trees, they've got to be there, you see. Anyway, we were fortunate, we dug in, we got round, we dug in, they'd cleared off. And
were these chaps from your company?
No, they wasn't.
No, from the battalion?
This just shows you how bad the haze was, you see, because before you go in, you've got other chaps dropping from the independent companies who put down markers. Now, these pilots couldn't have seen these markers, but knew they was over that area, so they dropped them. And when you realise they came from the 8th Battalion, actually, they must have been, they was a good, mile and a half, 2 miles away from the DZ, which was allocated to them. But then he did put attacks in, but we repelled them. And I have to say it because the order come round, we don't know who started, it wasn't our officer, that was a dead cert, but the order come round, no prisoners. Well, anybody would realise why, not when you saw those lads up there. They never had a chance, so we thought, why should we give them buggers a bloody chance, you see? A company to our right was we heard that over our radio. They was in a hell of a state over there, but they repelled every attack themselves. They fought back everything. C Company was the same as us, sort of half and half. Every attack they put in, we pushed them back. But then when the gliders came in, they'll never capture the scenes on television. They'll never capture it on films. The havoc those 88s caused amongst those gliders. You see a glider coming in, the next minute, boom, it's gone in half. Out's fallen, we saw artillery guns come out, jeeps fall out, bodies fall out. They never stood a chance of poor sods. I mean, they didn't have no chutes. We did have chutes, we had a chance. And then even when they landed, they were still under every fire from machine gun fire, you see. And if any man, that includes yourselves, if you come across a man who said he went to war in a glider, shake hands with that man because you're shaking hands with a hero. You really are. And that goes for the Royal Army Medical Corps men. They were bloody heroes. Well, eventually, word came through. Word came through that our CO had been shot through the nose. He wouldn't take any medical aid. He flatly refused to give in until things settled down. Well, eventually, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, word come through that all our objectives had been taken, bearing in mind that the glider boys were still fighting. The 3rd Para Regiment was still having a battle with theirs, but about 5 o'clock in the evening, everything was more or less back to normal. And then we got pushed out to a farmhouse where we had to dig in. I don't know who the clever bugger was, but he put us right beside it. We didn't see it at the time because the night had fallen by then. Right beside a bloody dung heap, of all places. And with the midges and the mozzies out there, same as in France, they were buggers. There was plenty of them. And then I got one of the lads, he'd already bandaged me thumb up when I landed. He put a quick bandage round. Then I got sent down to the first aid post. He put 6 stitches in, but I didn't see him do that. I'd passed out. And because when I come to and saw the bandage round there, I thought, it's got to be a blighty. What we know, a blighty, we're going to be sent back to blighting. When I said to this corporal, I said, does it mean I'm going back to blighty? No, mate. He said, you're all right. He said, what hand you, what do you, who do you write, what do you write with? I said, the right hand. He said, well, you pull the trigger with your right finger, don't you? So I said, yeah, why? Well, he said, you pull that with the right finger, you hold your bloody Sten gun, he said, in your left hand, don't you?
So that was it. Wounded in your left
hand? Just in the left hand. Then I got one in the, in, just there.
In your left
hand? That was only a flesh, they're only flesh wounds, you see. And then it was a question of settling back. You know, as I say, we dug in, settled back. We had a meal. What we made ourselves out of our few compo rations we had. And then he didn't put no attacks in. Jerry very seldom fought at night, believe it or not. But 4 o'clock in the morning was his start time, more or less. So we always used to stand to it at 4 o'clock. And then when it got light and we realised things, you know, had quietened down, he wasn't going to put no attack, then the orders come round, you know, smart yourselves up as best as you could. So with the cold water that we had, cold shave, a bit of a wash, a bit more grub, and we got ready to move out, where we were waiting for the Second Army to come through, and then suddenly somebody shouted out, bloody hell, tanks. And you could hear these tracks. Now, a tank, when it's moving, you can hear those tracks quite a long way. So, we're straight away, everybody's on the alert. Guns cocked, everything's ready, rifles, mortars, piets, everything's ready to meet the onslaught, you see. But as luck would have it, it was a Bren gun carrier, followed by a couple more. And who were they? And I was quite proud at that moment. They came from the Middlesex Regiment. Now, Middlesex Regiment, the barracks is only up the road here, and I had my medical in the TA centre down at Deansbrook Road here.
We're in Mill Hill now.
Yeah, you're in Mill Hill, but that was Burnt Oak, and the barracks was there. They got a TA centre, Middlesex Regiment TA. Well, it's not the Middlesex now, it's the Queen's, but they had that before the war. And it was them that came through, it wasn't tanks, it was them. And that's when we met up with the Second Army. So we got rested again. They said, well, rest until further notice. And then later on in the day, we'll get ready to move out. Oh, you always got 20 minutes to move out for some unknown reason. So we got ourselves prepared and away we went. Well, I wish we had cameras that we could have taken film. You've got to believe what I'm telling you now. We used everything that we could get to carry anything. Prams, wheelbarrows. There was another type of wheelbarrow. It was mainly for carrying the dung around in more than anything. Quaint little thing. But anything that was on wheels that could carry anything, we used it. So, we don't know where the officers got the horses from, but half a dozen of the officers found horses. And away we went. And we had to pass the guards. Of all people, we had to pass the guards. Now, everybody knows what the guards are like. They are smart. Nobody can take that credit away from them. They are smart and always will be. And even then, they looked as though they were ready to go on parade. What their regimental sergeant major thought of us, I don't really know. He must have had heart attack after heart attack. But we moved on, and then it was a question then. Our first major battle was at a place called Earl, E-R-L-E. I think it was C Company got pinned down on the crossroads. So A Company was sent out to the left flank. We were sent out to the right flank through the woods. And by then, night time was falling. And then Mr. Hinman was ordered to take a patrol out with 4 piets. Now, I shall never understand to this day, because the man concerned is dead now, Tommy. But we had to take 4 piets with us. Well, you can imagine a semi-moonlight night, and the cover was very sparse. I mean, there was an edge row. It didn't matter if it was on the other side of Jerry. You stood this side of it. You couldn't walk across the field. Anyway, we got into a position that you could see these, actually see the guns. But there was more than what you could see, actually. We didn't know at the time. 11, if I remember rightly. But we could only see, I think it was about 3 we saw. And you've got to understand that whatever talking was going was done in very, very quiet whispers. And Corporal Colleen, as he was, said to Mr. Hyman, I've got all those 3 guns straight away, because if not, we've had it. But he decided no. So we came back. It was then decided that everybody was to be issued with a Sten gunner, take 1 Bren gunner. Now, the chap I had to go and see, Lance Corporal Sanderson, Tommy Sanderson, came from York. Wonderful chap, very nice, like very fair-haired lad, but liked by everybody. I went to his sergeant, Sergeant Cherry, and I said, Tommy's got to bring his Bren gun, we're going out to take the place. Now, he called Tommy over, he said, get your gun, son. He said, you've got to go on this patrol. And I can see Tommy right now doing it. He took the sling off the Bren gun. Everybody took their slings off the Sten because we bandaged them up with black tape. No noise, no nothing. If you had a ring and you couldn't get it off, it was either blackened or taped up, you see. And he said to Reg Cherry, here, give that to the next bloke. I won't be needing it. Now, Cherry comes from Jersey. And I can remember his words. Don't bloody talk like that, man. Tommy never spoke a truer word. We went on that. We went down, we attacked these guns. As I say, there was 11 in all, plus, Smizers, Mausers. How many prisoners? There were 6 Jerrys were killed, and I think there was about, I think it was 30 or 40 odd prisoners taken. And Tommy was killed.
How was he killed?
Shot by a machine gun. Right through the head. You know, it's ironic. Whether that man had a premonition or not, it's hard to say, really. But we buried old Tommy the next day, but there was no flags, no television cameras, no ordinary cameras to that extent, no crowds, no music, no bugles. We just buried Tommy. He was only a para, but he was a smashing bloke, but he was one of our mates. And when a para dies, the other paras do feel. We do have tears. We can cry, you know. But
what was this place?
Erle. It's about 20 miles the other side of Hamilton. But he was the only one that was killed there. Lofty was put in for he was mentioned in dispatches eventually, but he was also put in for an award, but he never got one. Private Mecking got the MM, and Corporal Noble got the MM out of that. And then it was the next move up was, there was Earl, then we had to go through, Mundon was another place we had to take. Nothing big in that battle. The thing that stands out in my mind with Mundon, sitting on the crossroad, is there was a German behind a machine gun, believe it or not. And somebody had written a notice and hung it round his neck.
A dead German?
Yeah. Got any fags, chum? I've been here a long time. Now, this was the... It's callous, again, to say it, but this was the wit of the German, of the British Tommy. There's always somebody in your section, your company, who's got the wit. You have to meet one in every... No matter what unit you visit, you'll find one. And then from London, it was up through Craven, or Graven, or whichever way you like to pronounce it. And then came Osnabrück was another big place. But there was the 5th Para, 3rd Para Brigade, plus the Commandos, because you appreciate Osnabrück's a very big place. And we was landed with the job of attacking a big barracks, and it was a big barracks. Buckingham Palace was small compared to it. Well, if you put yourself in my place, you're going across the barrack room, the barrack square, and you've got to take this place, and you think, Christ, why aren't they firing? And it's in your mind all the time, for Christ's sake, fire, let's know where you are. And we was 3/4 of the way over before the penny dropped. Nobody was there. They'd scarpered. God was on our side. It's as simple as that. Anyway, we still had to check the place out because the German soldier was a past master at booby traps. He really was. You could pick up the simplest of things thinking it was nothing. He'd booby trap it. Pens, pencils. Now, who would think a pencil could be booby trapped? He knew how to do it. Take the rubber piece off the top. He'd have something inside just to cause a hand injury, mind you. Well, then down the corridor, I'm going through my section, and one of the boys shouted out, he said, there's some Jerry's down. You could hear this German voices talking, but I can't speak German, so I don't know what they were saying. So I left these lads behind, myself with two others. We crept forward with the hand grenades. In went the hand grenades. They went off. We could still hear this German voice. So we charged in, ready to shoot. And what was it? A radio room. They'd left the radio on. It took us nearly 3 weeks to live that one down, I tell you. But you see, as I say, I can't speak German, I can't read German, so I couldn't read the word outside the room. But that's how edgy you got. You couldn't take no chances of any description whatsoever, you see. And then from Osnabrück, we come to it was our worst battle of the lot. We was told we was going to go across Wanstorf airfield.
Which airfield?
Wanstorf. Wunstorf. Wanstorf. Now, this place had already been cleared by the recce, reconnaissance people. Nothing there. Go straight over the airfield. Go straight through the woods. You'll come to Neustadt. Neustadt. And in Neustadt, there is a bridge. We now know to be the bridge over the River Line. Leine. Now, the object of this, to capture this bridge, because the Americans was putting a big push through to Hanover. And this was one of the roads that led up to Hanover. That was to stop any Germans using it. So off we went. Happy. I was in the leading truck. Mr. Himmel was in the front, sitting on the back with a couple of lads. We got about 200 yards to go before we hit this woods. And all hell broke loose. And it was a couple of seconds before we realised we were being fired on. I've never seen lorries cleared so quick in all my life. Now you've got to imagine what an airfield's like. It's not bumpy. It's dead flat. You try hiding behind blades of grass while someone's firing at you. The tyres, we just heard the hissing sound and they were just shred to bits, the tyres. You could see the bullet marks alongside, the wooden sides of the trucks. Well, the Bren gunner got hit. I took the Bren gun over. And it was just a question of firing anywhere in front of you, at the woods, at this house that was on the other side of the road, because they were firing from there. And then I heard of somebody from the back shouting out, Christ, they're firing from their aircraft. And as we was going through this, it wasn't a proper road, but it's well made up, there was these aircraft parked, and they were firing from these aircraft.
From the cockpit?
I don't know where they were firing from, actually. I never took the trouble to find out, to be honest with you. But I did hear, this was a good 30-odd years later when I spoke about it at one of the reunions, and when the bloke said no, he said they were hiding behind the wheels. And I said, well, surely we would have seen them. He said, well, we didn't, did we? But he seems to think it was from the, they were hiding behind the wheels or probably behind the tail plane, you see. But anyway, I'd taken the Bren gun.